This is the Falcoholic Podcast, the official podcast of the Atlanta Falcons on the SB Nation Podcast Network. I am David Walker, you can call me DW, and today I'm joined by my co-host Gina Thomas and our fellow editor at the site, Matt Chambers. Hi guys, I hope you're both doing well.
Thank you, David. I hope you are too.
Thank you.
David, I can sum up my emotions as woo!
which is quite different from normal. Anyhow, this podcast is a follow-up to one we had earlier in the year when we were still in the early days of the pandemic. Today, we are joined again by the two experts that discussed that point in time of where we are as a country. And now we're going to talk about the outlook for this year, the outlook for sports in 2020. And in particular, our focus, obviously, is the NFL, which is slated to kick off about 1 month from now, with training camp starting in late July. So first, we are joined by Dr. Saad Omer. He is an American vaccinologist and the director of the Yale Institute for Global Health. Dr. Omer, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
We are also joined by Dr. Zach Binney out of Emory. He is an epidemiologist and a sports fan, and he certainly has a lot of thoughts on the plausibility of each sports league having some kind of season in 2020. Dr. Binney, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome, and it's true, I do have takes.
Which is why we have both of you on as experts, and also hopefully to speak to some of the specifics of the sports that we all passionately love. All right, let's dive into it. So first, I just want to start with where we are as a country. Obviously, a lot of people watch the news, they read the newspapers and watch the TV. But I want to get from both of you, Dr. Omer, Dr. Binney, your take on where we currently are as a country, where the pandemic is concerned. Dr. Omer, I'll turn it over to you first, and Dr. Binney, you can go after him.
So we had some signs of hope up until a few weeks ago, where there was at least stabilization in our new cases, in the sense the new cases being identified each day, each week, were tapering down, although there wasn't a sort of a drastic fall, but it was qualitatively a bit of a plateau. But recently we have had a real rise in cases in certain regions where it wasn't there before. The outbreak started from the West Coast, but quickly spread to the Northeast, and those were the areas most affected by this outbreak. Now it's in other states like Texas, Arizona, South Carolina, etc. And so there is a real increase in cases. A little bit of a silver lining, but that comes with a caveat of its own, is that the deaths haven't gone up with the same speed, or haven't sort of increased compared to the cases themselves. So there could be a few reasons. One of the things we know that the outbreak currently in the regions where it's happening is in younger people. So in younger people, the death rate for all respiratory diseases like influenza and others, although this is much more severe than influenza, but the pattern is similar. The mortality, the deaths are higher in older age groups. So since the outbreak is spreading in younger populations, we are seeing a lower death rate. The other benefit of distributing this, the so-called flattening the curve, is that the health system has at least initially more capacity, although it's maxing out fairly quickly in certain parts of the country. And you're able to reduce mortality. And we certainly have a couple of new tools, a couple of drugs, in our toolbox to be able to reduce the likelihood of death once you get sick. But that doesn't mean the risk has gone away. As the outbreak has a real possibility, from even if it starts in young people, to spread to the older age groups, etc. But I don't expect the mortality rate to be at the same level as it was earlier on, but it is likely to go up further.
Right. Dr. Binney, your thoughts on that as well?
Yeah, I don't know what to expect with deaths yet. I think they're a lagging indicator, and we still have a lot of time for them to start to look very, very bad, but it could be that they do look a lot better than the sort of thing we saw before, because younger people are getting sick. That's certainly a possibility worth considering, for sure. I think, you know, what we're seeing is that some places that thought they could reopen faster than was recommended are seeing the consequences of that. And there's a little bit of randomness, right? Not everywhere that opened is exploding. Not everywhere that didn't open is doing perfectly, because there is some just variation with this virus, where there's a lot of, some people don't transmit it to anybody, but a few people seem to transmit it to a lot of folks. So if you get one of those kind of, a few of those big spreading events, things can get out of hand very, very quickly. And I think that's what we're seeing with bars, for example, in Florida, right, Texas, and Arizona. So that's the other thing is, you know, we're seeing different waves of disease in different places at the same time or at different times. So some areas are getting better, some are worse, but we're also learning more about what is really causing this spread. And I think that's going to allow us to be a little more targeted in our interventions in the future, these sort of non-pharmaceutical interventions, even beyond testing, tracing, and isolating, which remains very important. But like when we see rising cases and it gets maybe beyond the realm where testing, tracing, and isolating can handle it, what do we really need to roll back on? And we're seeing that it's things like bars and probably not things like playgrounds or parks, right? So we can be a little more targeted with our interventions.
And that's a fantastic point. And I think a couple of the states, Texas, I believe Florida, have both rolled back the bars being open. And to your point, when we discussed this a few months ago, the virus, there were still a tremendous number of unknowns about it. Is it fair to say now that indoor activities where, in particular, you've got air conditioning systems that are sort of rotating the air around these indoor spaces, these indoor areas are particularly problematic where this virus is concerned? Not to dismiss the potential for spread in outdoor areas, but are those indoor areas particularly problematic where COVID-19 is concerned?
If I could give people two pieces of advice, number one would be avoid crowded indoor spaces. Mm-hmm. Number two would be wear your mask at all times that you're around other people outside your house. I also think we should be avoiding unnecessary large crowds outdoors, because that still gets together a lot of people, and especially in areas with a lot of virus. And if mask usage is not near 100%, there's a very real chance, I still think, for large scale transmission and an explosive outbreak from that. But really, if you in your personal life can mask up and avoid crowded indoor spaces, I think you're doing a lot to contribute to the control of COVID-19 as we learn more.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But if I may add, why do we think the risk goes up? A, there is empirical evidence. They have now, as you alluded to, that we have more information, and there have been several studies following up these outbreaks, etc. The so-called contact tracing studies that look at the risk factors. And a few things are pretty salient in these investigations. First, as Dr. Binney suggested, that indoor spaces, but the way it happens is that if you have less volume of air which is not moving, and we know that this is the biggest way of transmission, is these sort of droplet-based transmission. So not necessarily things hanging out in the air for hours and hours. That happens perhaps in a limited situation like a high-risk healthcare situation. But overall, sort of these droplets are there for a little while at least, and there is not a lot of ventilation. And people are trying to speak loudly over the noise. Those kinds of situations increase the risk substantially, especially if they're, if you're in a bar, you're eating, drinking, etc. It's impractical to keep a mask on all the time. Right. I'll give you I'll tell you about a very interesting study, which is an analog to what we are seeing and some of these recommendations. In Korea, in South Korea, they looked at these gym classes. So different kinds of, you know, in gyms, you have like high intensity training, kind of that family of classes, spin classes that are very sort of active, Zumba classes, but then you have yoga and Pilates as well. What they figured out was that even when the instructor was infected, there was zero infection in yoga and Pilates classes compared to Zumba and those kinds of sort of high activity classes. Hmm. And the reason that seems to be is that not just coughing, but speaking loudly and projecting your voice. That's why another piece of data comes from choirs, that choirs or sort of even a cappella groups, etc., that kind of singing is a higher, you know, I work at Yale, and a cappella groups for some reason are a big deal here. So that comes to my mind as examples. And so those kinds of things increase the risk substantially. So, and that there are analogs to sports as well. In confined, you know, sometimes it's open air spaces, but sometimes, you know, when you're grabbing food, etc., you congregate and so on and so forth. So going forward, but also for teams, etc. So the locker room environment, other places where players congregate. So these insights help us inform decision making in those kinds of situations.
And to that point, it correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe with the MERS outbreak, when that happened in South Korea, they traced it back to patient zero actually having transmitted it in a church where she was singing. And they believe that that was the point at which it really began to spread like a wildfire there. So to your point, it does seem like that the exhalation, whether it's through talking, singing, coughing seems to be a trigger for many of these viral outbreaks.
Yeah, especially if you're in a confined space. Yeah. If you're outdoors, the risk is not zero, but it's lower because there's sort of more natural ventilation and so on and so forth.
Yeah. Matt, you want to hit them with a follow-up question from our original podcast?
Sure. So it's been about 2.5 months. I feel like a lot has changed. And then at the same point, very, very little has changed from early to mid-April. And I know that we left that podcast with, your consensus recommendations being we need more testing and we need more contact tracing. And I know that since the shortage in, earlier in the pandemic, that has leveled off a little bit. I don't know if testing is necessarily where we still need it to be, but contact tracing is still something that has not necessarily taken a hold over here in the U.S., at least as far as I'm aware of. I'm just curious if you still think that that is our path forward, or if in the last 2.5 months, if you think that there's a better end to this pandemic that has some different requirements.
So Zach, do you want to go first, or I have a few thoughts about this as well?
No, Saad, I'd love you to start on this, and then I'll chime in with anything that I'm thinking that you don't say. But I think you're a little more of the expert on this than I am.
So I'd be happy to start the discussion. So there are a few new insights. So our estimate of the proportion of people who are asymptomatic has solidified. So we had, even at that time, some evidence that a lot of people are asymptomatic and they may be transmitting. We now know that approximately for each identified case, there are 9 to 10 cases that are not identify either sort of asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic if you look at those cross sections. And they are likely to be contributing to, it is uncertain to what extent, there are different estimates, to transmission in the community and all sorts of settings. So therefore, there is a little bit more emphasis on masks in that period. But coming back to the, starting the game, again, and sort of having a season or a semblance of a season, there are a few considerations. So I think the policy goal of NFL and each team, and sort of, it sounds common sense, But you know, it needs to be articulated, should be zero mortality, that there should be zero deaths in this kind of a situation. Then you work backwards to what number of cases, based on the risk profile of the players, because they are in a kind of certain BMI, a lot of our players are African Americans, and we know that there's a higher risk in, you know, of disease and adverse outcome in the African American community in the U.S. So keeping that in mind, keeping that profile in mind, you can sort of come to a level of tolerance for actual number of cases. Having said that, then you should have, you build a buffer, a pretty substantial buffer for uncertainty. But if any team expects that there will be zero cases, then it's a non-starter. Then you're not, I can tell you that when you have this level of congregation of people, even without any crowds, you're going to have cases. But if the policy goal is zero, like a really high chance, a 99% or 95% chance of zero deaths, you can work with those numbers and get to an expected number of cases that would give you that safety margin. So how do you get to those expected number of cases? One is sort of good old testing and contact tracing. So very aggressive, that hasn't gone away. But also the frequency of testing is important. The more frequent you have, the earlier you can catch. So for example, in Massachusetts, the requirement, so a good sort of example or similar situation is college dorms, where sort of people are in close quarters, et cetera. Similar, not exactly the same age groups, et cetera. At least there are not a lot of people, you know, other than professors, et cetera, but at least people who are living in dorms are relatively younger. Their state of, you know, the Massachusetts plan calls for twice a week testing. The Connecticut state plan suggests once a week testing. But these are floors. And now that we have tests and sort of enough tests that you can say that you're not taking away from medical care, I would say a very aggressive regime of testing is the bare minimum for sort of opening up the games, etc. So that plus very aggressive social distancing policies in the locker room, where the team lives, how they interact with each other, where anyone who doesn't need to be unmasked is unmasked, and so on and so forth. So a lot of risk mitigation, etc. That can give you at least the parameters. Then I would suggest each team work with their own quantitative shops to quantify that risk and take a policy decision which is not based on sort of people's hunches, which is based on actual numbers.
Right. So we can get back to talking about specifically like what it would take for the NFL to come back or for any sports team to come back. But if you were asking generally about for the country, testing, tracing, and isolating, I think the ideal strategy is still the same. I think that it's harder to do that when you're starting from such a high level of cases. So the goal really was to get the number of cases down to a very low number that can be relatively easily caught with the amount of testing and contact tracing infrastructure that we have. And I think some areas are actually pretty well set up to do that. And other areas are, you know, beyond where we would hope they would be. That is not an argument for not investing in contact tracing programs or for abandoning that strategy. Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And your goal should be to get your number of cases back down below that level where the programs become incredibly successful. And those programs can be part of getting down below that level. It's just if things get really crazy, you may need to be taking more strict steps to get it down to the level where there's where those programs can do what they need to do.
Yeah, just to add to that, sorry, so I took it in a slightly different direction, but at the national level, or even in high-risk states, the other part of the strategy should be to minimize the likelihood of the so-called super spreader events. The other sort of insight that has developed this is that a lot of cases are being caused by the so-called super spreaders or a fewer number of people rather than a sort of a more even average of cases caused by everyone at a pretty similar rate. So in that kind of a situation, if you are looking at events, or sort of situations like bars, but also other similar kinds of events where you could have potential super spreading, you decrease the overall risk.
Absolutely.
Well, and I think that, you know, one of those things that has the potential to be a super spreader event is any kind of live sporting event in an arena or in a stadium with fans. And I'm very curious to know each of your professional opinions about, I mean, I realize that the NFL is just trying to mitigate risk at this point. There's no way to eliminate risk in a pandemic like this, especially with a virus that's so contagious. But is there any way to let even just a set number of fans into a stadium? You know, I don't think that it will be possible to enforce mask wearing. You're also going to have plenty of staff on hand, security staff, I'm assuming concession staff, unless they just shut that down. And I'm just having a hard time, and obviously I have no science or medical background, but I'm having a hard time seeing how that could be safe. And so I'm curious if you see any way that that could happen in a even remotely safe way.
I don't know. Next question.
Yeah, no, exactly. So I don't see the possibility of that. Doing it safely for any sport or for sort of most sort of sports to happen this fall or sort of in the next 5-6 months because it's just too high a risk. And the other thing, the other uncertain thing is, look, we haven't seen the full-on circulation of this virus in the peak respiratory season. So every year we have seasonal outbreaks of viruses like influenza and respiratory syncytial virus. And sort of we look out for these outbreaks starting in fall, going into, even through February, March. But it was in March that this virus started going up. So even in suboptimal transmission conditions where the humidity is low, for example, and the temperature is a bit low, so things that are, and people are more indoors naturally because of the weather, these are conditions for transmission. And a lot of the season happens during those situations. And we are looking at, again, on top of that, a prospect of a pretty substantial second wave. I cannot guarantee or cannot predict the exact size of a wave, but things are, even if everyone does goes back to aggressive measures as a hypothetical right now, it takes time for things to slow down. So under those specific scenarios, that's the long counterpart to Zach's answer of a short no. I don't see a scenario where you're going to see spectators in the stadium.
Sure. No, I think those are excellent points, and I'll add a little bit onto that, which is the way that we think about taking any steps back towards normality is any step that we take should have benefits that outweigh the risks. So I'm not trying to tell you to stay completely at home isolated for the next 6 months. I understand as well as anybody that that's not a reasonable request, but we need to find relatively safer activities that we can engage in. For example, one of the things that I love to do is pub trivia. The bar that I like to go to, fortunately, I know the owner very well. We texted a lot and talked a lot back and forth about how they could bring this back safely because he's the host. And we settled on patio only, spaced out tables, everybody's wearing a mask, and we think we can do this safely. And that's what they've done for the last few weeks, and I've been going because I think it's a low-risk event. But and when you talk about bringing sports back without fans, I think there's a real case to be made for benefits there in terms of psychological, in terms of helping people to see the light at the end of the tunnel, give people something to do at home, so that they're not compelled to go out. I think there's a lot of real benefits here. You lose me when you start talking about adding fans, because without fans, if the right plan is put together, I genuinely think the benefits can outweigh the risks. With fans, the only benefit that's being added is money for the teams and the owners and the stadium authorities. And the added risk is enormous. And I don't think the calculus works out there with any number of fans in favor of doing that. I don't agree with that, because we also talked about the duty and the values that leagues should be setting for any sort of return to play. I agree that protecting their employees is important, their players and their staff, but they also need to be held accountable to protecting the public's health. And they should not be creating a hazard to public health, which could be massive spread among their players and staff who then go out into the world and infect other people, or it could be creating an environment in which you could have a super spreader event. And I don't think it's okay for any league to do that to the public. I don't.
I completely agree with you. And I think especially as we're looking at the recent spikes, Florida and Texas, obviously two states that have had major increases in their coronavirus diagnoses over the past couple of weeks. And those states are home to 36 combined Division I programs and 5 NFL franchises, not to mention that the NBA was planning to resume play at Walt Disney World in Florida. I guess my other question is, as it relates to the sports, looking at where we are right now and the fact that the NFL is planning to start training camp in less than a month, do you think that that's really feasible? I mean, they just had to ask players within the past few days to stop doing workouts together, private workouts, and to follow the CDC's recommendations, because the league is obviously very concerned about virus spread. But is there a way to get teams back to their facilities and safely practicing for training camp within a month?
I think it's easier to do in some areas than others, but I'm still honestly optimistic about the NFL being able to pull off its season. But what it really depends on is what the plan looks like for training camp and the season. And I think we still haven't seen that. Mm-hmm. And if it looks like the NBA's plan with not going to a central location for a bubble, I think that ship has sailed. But what I've been advocating for are sort of home market bubbles. And these are especially important in areas with a lot of viral spread, where you say, okay, we're going to book a couple hotels near the stadium. They're going to be for our use and our use only. We're going to create this closed loop where we only ever travel from the hotel to the stadium and back. It's not going to be pleasant for players or staff. You may be asking them to leave their families. Players may not want to do that, and I completely understand that. I do 100%. But in areas with rampant viral spread, it may be the only way you can, even with testing, regular testing, be able to stop an explosive outbreak within a team. I'm really afraid for that, which is why I'm afraid that MLB's plan, which relies on people staying at home and playing in home markets, and they're just relying on testing to catch everything, I unfortunately think that's going to fail in areas with rampant viral spread, which right now include Arizona, Texas, and Florida, and South Carolina, but could be somewhere totally different in a month. So then other teams could get knocked out. And just how do you deal with that schedule-wise? How do you deal with it competitively? I'd much rather make the investment up front to try and have a system that will work when things get bad somewhere, rather than waiting to react. And so depending on whether the NFL's plan looks more like the NBA's or MLB's, that'll really determine for me how likely I think we are to have a season. But I'm optimistic.
Interesting.
Yeah, so I would say I 100% agree with that. I think there are strategies that are viable, but it comes down to the tactics. It comes down to the operational level, how you're implementing these strategies and how you are, sort of what is the level of compliance and so on and so forth. Are you disincentivizing sort of people hiding their symptoms, not just the players, but the whole ecosystem that goes on, that is attached to having a season even without fans and so on and so forth. So a lot of it will be based on these kinds of details and how they're implemented. But yeah, I concur that there is hope there, but there's you know, this is serious business. I hope there are ways to implement these kinds of strategies fairly aggressively.
Yeah,
I think that, you know, MLB's plan is great if the MLB were in Germany or South Korea or New Zealand, but they're not. We're here. We have to be realistic about that, and we have to come up with a plan that's going to work for us, and it's going to be stricter, and it's going to be harder and more expensive and worse for the players. But, you know, we're reaping what we sowed, and we have to confront that. And I think that is the situation that we're facing right now.
Yeah, I agree. And as somebody whose career is dependent on the NFL and other sports coming back, obviously I want sports to come back, but I want them to come back without putting people at unnecessary risk. I do not want anybody to die or to, you know, experience any of these long-term effects that COVID can cause.
Right. And I think, you know, you're always making a calculated risk, but again, it's about the risks and the benefits. And can you set up a system that where the benefits outweigh the risks? And I think you can. And we're going to wait and see what the system's going to look like.
Yeah, that's very encouraging.
It is. I'd like to get your opinions on something, a recent trend I've seen amongst some sports professionals writers. This one I think is a little bit controversial because I've seen some writers suggest, in particular with some of the outbreaks we've seen in some of the college football programs, I believe. Gina, what was the number at Clemson? How many players?
37 players 37. On the roster tested positive.
Right. Dr. Omer, Dr. Benny, I want to get your thoughts on this idea of just letting the players get infected so that they could have the antibodies and get over it and be fine and actually play a season versus actually trying to keep people from getting infected. Your thoughts on some sports writers beginning to adopt that as a talking point.
Can I curse on this podcast?
Yes, you can.
Okay.
Sure.
So I'm already on record as swearing in the Toledo Blade, I believe. But no, let me give the actual answer first, because I think you can approach this from an angle of misunderstanding, but you can approach this in good faith. So what you're thinking is, these are young elite athletes. There's zero risk if they get sick. Why not let them get sick? Let me explain why that's misguided. Number one is you are still creating new cases in the middle of a global pandemic. And these young elite athletes who may not suffer any symptoms themselves can spread the disease to older coaches, older athletics personnel, yep. Older family members. So you're putting them at risk by just allowing this spread. Number two is the risk isn't zero. Rudy Gobert, first NBA player to have COVID-19 just this past week, said that, you know, over 3 months later, he still doesn't have his sense of smell completely back.
Wow.
Von Miller, a pass rusher with the Broncos, for at least 2 months was suffering breathing problems. Now, he has asthma, but still, that tells you that it's not nobody who's going to have a problem here, okay? We've seen this great Twitter thread from an Olympian who described how he'd been struggling with COVID-19 symptoms for weeks. So this risk is not zero for these young elite athletes. And if there are any long-term consequences, which, you know, the disease has only been around 6 or 7 months, so if you ask me, what do your lungs look like a year after you get COVID? I literally can't tell you that. That knowledge doesn't exist in the universe, but we've seen some evidence that's somewhat concerning for that so far. And, you know, if I lose 5% of my lung function, I run a 45-minute 5K instead of a 40-minute one, right? Who cares? But it could be truly devastating for the career of an elite athlete. So you want to think about that as well. So, it's not zero risk. If you're being intellectually honest, what you're actually saying is the risk is low enough, but still there, but it's low enough that these are people, but I don't care. I'd rather have them play for me. Mm. Okay. And if that's your conclusion, that's fine, but be intellectually honest about it is all I'm asking. And if everything I've said doesn't convince you that this is a bad idea to just let COVID-19 burn through a team of players because they'll be fine, then I will say, go fuck yourself.
Oh, that fits
because
perfectly
then you're
in this
no
podcast.
Longer arguing in good faith. There's no good faith after that. That's just sociopathic.
Yes, absolutely.
Dr. Rowe, anything to add on to that?
Yeah, what he said, especially in the end. No, seriously. I understand. So both of us come from a position where we recognize and appreciate the value of sports in our mm-hmm. lives.
Right.
The value of sports for psychological health. The value of sports for livelihoods of tens of thousands of people all around this country. So we appreciate that. And that's why we spend time thinking about approaches for all sorts of situations where you can safely do this. But this the so-called herd immunity strategy. So a lot of my own research is on vaccines. And one of the main public health strategy you employ by vaccinating a high number of people is through herd immunity. But herd immunity through infection is a very dangerous strategy. They tried it in countries like Sweden, where if you compare them to other Scandinavian countries, which is the more apt comparison, they have many fold higher rates of infections and deaths. It's a dangerous approach. The other caveat is we don't know. Our best guess is that most people who get infected will develop immunity, at least for the first few years. But we don't know what exact fraction of people will develop immunity after infection and the precise length of how long it will last. But also, equally importantly, what level of antibody will be protective against infection? And we are actively studying all of those questions. But it's a new virus, 5-6 months old, and a strategy that says that, let them get infected and they will develop protection has way too many unknowns to meet that goal that you shouldn't have deaths and severe consequences to your players, your staff, your coaches, etc.
Fantastic. And Dr. Ummer, to that point, I think would you say it's safe to say that we still, as much as we've learned about this virus over the past 5 or 6 months, there is still equally an amount we don't know, as you mentioned about the how long the antibodies actually protect us for, what the correct amount is. So is it still that level of uncertainty, the things that we don't know, that still causes you pause when we are talking about sports, when we're talking about infection, when we're talking about the long-term impact of this virus on people's bodies? Is that unknown in your profession? Is that one of the things that you still want to get a grasp on before you can feel more comfortable with these things going forward?
That's correct. Again, remember, this is a really new virus. There were a lot of people infected, let's say, in China, and there was a lot of data that came out of China. But then when we started seeing cases in this country, we had our own set of surprises. Meaning the scientific community, found that it has a substantial impact on our blood vessels, on our cardiac risk factors, on our neurological system, and so on and so forth. And we found that there are these syndromes that are associated with this virus that are prevalent in children who get this infection. Not everyone gets that, but pretty substantial disease. So we are finding out more about this virus. We know about this virus way more than what we did 6 months ago, even a month ago, even a week ago. The science of this pandemic is moving forward with breakneck pace, with lightning speed, whatever metaphor you want to use. But we still have a lot of stuff that needs to be elicited.
So actually, this reminds me of something that I would really love an answer for on things that we don't know yet. I can back this up a little bit. So the NFL's current plans, or the rumor is that They are going to follow local guidelines for how many fans are allowed in a stadium and how that works out. And this actually brings up something interesting. If anyone wants to go to thefalcoholic.com, of course, our flagship website. Today, earlier in the week, by the time this posted, we had an interview with a season ticket holder who was diagnosed with coronavirus. He's only 35 years old, dealt with a lot of issues for about 2.5 months, had to go to the emergency room at least one time. And he said, there is no way I'm going to step back into the stadium at all this year. And we did a little bad blogger math. And if you just work out your basic numbers on the number of people in Georgia who are sick and the number of people who would be in a full Mercedes-Benz Stadium, if they allow 100% of those people in there, you might have 550 or so people sick at each and every game. But, you know, one of the bigger considerations right now is, I don't know if we actually have any sort of data, if we have any understanding on how that might spread in something like a stadium, whether or not it's open, closed top. If you have 550 people there, does this turn into a potentially super spreader event that, it infects countless more? Actually, Dr. Binney, that might be a great question for you.
What is the probability that it happens? I mean, I haven't sat down and done the math, but gathering.
Do we know those numbers? Do we have any sort of data on that issue, in specifically in stadiums?
I mean, we have the number of positive tests that we know. Certainly, I would be. And we can back out from that to the probability that X number of people who show up to a game with Y number of fans are sick. And then you would need to come up with like a probability of transmission within a stadium. But particularly here with Mercedes-Benz, you have the retractable roof. But for all intents and purposes, to me, it's an indoor stadium. The concourses are indoors. I certainly agree with the season ticket holder you spoke with. I wouldn't be going anywhere near Mercedes-Benz Stadium for anything until there's a vaccine, just period.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. So I've run some numbers for similar situations, or have seen numbers run by colleagues as well for situations like dorms, etc. So similar situations, but not exactly the same. I can tell you, based on that assessment, I wouldn't be able to say whether, you know, the next game is going to have a super spreader event. But in a season, I can tell you there's a really high probability of more than one super spreader event if games are played with full capacity, for example, in Atlanta. So, I see the perspective of the person you talk to, that it is fairly high risk.
Right. And I think one important thing to understand is, if you're into sports analytics at all, is process over outcome. You might get lucky with one game or even two games, but eventually the dice are going to come up the wrong number. And you don't want to be rolling the dice more than you absolutely have to, or have worse odds than you absolutely have to have. And so, I don't know, why do that? Why roll the dice a whole bunch if you don't need to? I just wouldn't do that.
Yeah. Yep. By the way, hopefully I'll get to get a chance to talk about some good news on COVID front, because things haven't looked great, at least in the U.S. In the past few weeks, but there is some good news that is emerging that is helpful in, at least in the long run.
Actually, your timing was perfect, Dr. Omer. I was going to ask you both to give an outlook on what the coronavirus pandemic looks like over the next 5, 6, 10 months. Maybe speak towards the incredible development of the vaccines that are going around, not just in the U.S., but I think around the world. If I'm correct, there are vaccines in development in multiple countries that are progressing very quickly. Maybe some treatments, therapeutic treatments that could be on the horizon, and just general trends, anything you want to speak to that, to your point, maybe some good news in the midst of this pandemic that could be a light at the end of the tunnel for sports fans and, frankly, just for the general public.
Yeah, I think there's good news out of vaccines in the sense that there are a lot of serious products that are out there. There are around 12 vaccines in clinical trials, in human trials. There's a much bigger array of vaccines that people have, that companies or academics or sort of biotech firms have announced that they have a vaccine program. But the ones that are more advanced are in human trials. 5-6 of them, 2 Chinese products, 2 U.S. products, and a U.K. one are ahead of the pack. So far, the data look good, not perfect in one case, but look good in terms of the early human and animal trials. But there's a long way to go. So meaning that I'm not sure that we'll get a vaccine this fall or even by the end of the year. That's not a fantasy. That's within the range of possibilities. There are pathways that can take us there. My central estimate is still spring to summer next year. But even spring to summer is breakneck speed. That means that this is not a permanent situation. And the other good sign from the vaccine world is that there are multiple pathways to a successful vaccine that are being deployed. So the more you hedge your bets, so some are older technologies, so you know, basically taking a virus and taking away its disease potential by culturing it multiple times, but making sure that it still replicates, the so-called live attenuated vaccine, a technology similar to the measles vaccine, for example, that is out there as well. On the other hand, this really cutting-edge technology of messenger RNA, so this tiny piece of genetic code that our cells use to communicate to different parts of the cell itself, that is being deployed as well. That has the potential of inducing broad-based but still targeted against the virus immunity. So the fact that there's a range of things that is out there, that's really hopeful. And the fact that both small innovation-based products but also large pharmaceuticals who have the capacity to scale up production fairly quickly, they are in the game. That's a good news. The even better news is coming from the therapeutics front. So we have so-called antiviral, meaning that attacks the virus itself, that hasn't shown an impact on protecting against mortality or death, but has shown impact on reducing ICU stay, and may in the future show an impact against mortality. But then there's this really old school steroid that has been shown in the UK to reduce deaths, especially amongst those who are on ventilators. So that's good news. Another good news is the fact that these antibodies as treatment, so the so-called monoclonal antibodies, a single type of antibody that you produce and you give to people to protect against a disease, they are showing pretty good progress. So cumulatively, at least that increases our ability to get a handle on this outbreak. So that's the good news. I let, you know, because I took some time, I let Zach talk about the overall outlook.
Yeah, I mean, the overall outlook is really hard to make a prediction about. But if what we've seen so far is any indication, you're going to get different waves in different areas at different times. So some areas of the country are going to look fine, and some are going to be disaster zones if they open too quickly and too recklessly. Like we saw, I think, no question, in Arizona, in Texas, and in Florida. Maybe other states will learn their lessons. We'll have to see. Maybe there will be a strong seasonal effect and things will get worse across the board in the fall and winter. So places that were doing great do okay, and places that were doing bad get really bad. That's another possibility. Where is going to be the next place to explode? That's really, really hard to predict. So I think we just need to steel ourselves and set that expectation and understand that we can't get rid of this thing in a month. We really need to have sustainable steps that everybody in this country takes to reduce the likelihood of explosive spread. And that is severely restricting time indoors in large groups and doing as much masking as humanly possible, along with massive testing to root out cases and clusters and contact tracing to do the same thing. Now, to get back on the topic of a vaccine, I'll give you my sort of most optimistic pie in the sky dream, but that I think is still plausible. That would be if we get a vaccine by, say, January 2021, we're not going to have enough doses for everybody at the start. So that's the other thing, is like, it's not just getting a vaccine, it's getting a vaccine and having a lot of people vaccinated.
Right.
And that's going to take more time before we can really do fans. But one of the groups that we're probably going to vaccinate first are healthcare workers. So paint a picture in your heads. We get a vaccine in January 2021. And I am not saying this is likely. I'm saying that this is a possibility. Mm-hmm. So we've got that. February, Super Bowl, audience of healthcare heroes who have been vaccinated.
I like it.
Right? Would the NFL not love that?
Yeah.
Would then that be right up their alley? That's my sort of most optimistic thing. So if you want a target, if you're just a person and you're sitting at home and you find it so hard and so distasteful that, you know, you can't go to a sporting event or a concert, just think about that. Okay, that's our goal. And I really think that is doable for everybody to look at that and keep that in your mind's eye. And that could change. Right, if we start getting bad news on vaccines, which is a very real possibility, but that's the optimistic scenario if that's what you need to get through the day.
And I think that's a great way to wrap up the conversation.
Yeah.
I would just add one more thing to it. So one thing I have observed relatively recently in the past few weeks, that there's a sense of despondence and resignation that, you know, we're going to have a certain level of deaths. Some people are going to die. That's the nature of the beast. So this is not a group of people who underappreciate the severity of this outbreak, but they're resigned to it. I can tell you this, these are preventable deaths. And so that yep. realization comes of responsibility, that we are in this together. And the fact that we should... you know, it's not easy for businesses, for people to stay at a lower level of activity for a long period, but these are preventable deaths. Other countries, other jurisdictions have shown that these are preventable deaths. And so the reward, the payoff of these sacrifices we are making as a country, as a people, are worth it. Because on the other side are a few more or several more birthdays, Mother's Days, Father's Days, and reunions and graduation and weddings that are waiting to happen. So, you know, we need to stay the course a little bit. It's not easy. It's not tough. It demands sacrifice. But we can do it smartly. We can open up activities a little bit more than we were able to before. But until we have a set of vaccines, we will, this will require some sacrifice.
Right. And I think that it's on us as individuals. We all have a role to play, such as by avoiding large indoor gatherings, not doing risky things to contribute to our neighbor's risk, and wearing masks. But there's also a policy, a role for policy and government and institutions. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about, you know, the public health versus the economy, that's a false dichotomy. Okay. That's a policy choice that we've made. So if you look at the spread that's going on and you say, oh man, we really need to close bars, but how can we do that? They got to make money. They employ a lot of people. Well, what you do is you cut a check to the bars and you pay them to stay closed. Yeah. And you cover their payrolls. We are the richest country on earth. There is no reason we can't do that, except that we don't want to. And I think we need to ask ourselves, why don't we want to? And is that really the smartest thing we could be doing right now?
Completely agree. Dr. Omer, Dr. Benny, thank you so much again for joining us on the Falcoholic Podcast. I, for one, felt like this update was incredibly informative. I truly believe our listeners will find it incredibly informative as well. And I just want to give you both the opportunity to let our listeners and our readers know where they can find you, where they can keep track of you if you have some information to share.
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter and post. I've started posting, like other scientists, a little bit more. There are a lot of doctors and scientists and public health professionals that are more engaged now because of the value of right information. So my Twitter handle is Saad, S-A-A-D, Omer, O-M-E-R, 3, Saad Omer 3. That's my Twitter handle, and I'm there and provide sort of a lot of information. And I must say that, you know, one thing, you know, the last thing I'll say is that, as you know, that I moved from Atlanta to Connecticut in July, and one, you know, consequence of these restrictions is that I miss Atlanta more than I thought I would, because I'm not able to go back, I miss a lot of things, including sports, Atlanta sports. So there will be a time, hopefully, that I'll be able to go back or come back, depending on your perspective.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I'm on Twitter way too much. I'm at ZBinny, that's Z-B-I, double N as in November, E-Y, _ N-F-L-I-N-J for NFL injuries. You can also catch my sporadic work at footballoutsiders.com. I haven't written anything in a while, but rest assured I'm working behind the scenes, always working to update their injury data. So I may look quiet, but I'm always working.
Gina, Matt, why don't you remind our listeners, our readers, where they can find you?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at Gina Thomas. It's J-E-A-N-N-A Thomas, where I am often posting pictures of my dogs and yelling at people to wear masks. That's mostly what I do on Twitter now.
Yeah, you can find my very professional Twitter account, Falcoholic Matt, on twitter.com.
All right. And guys, of course, you can find me at Falcoholic DW. Follow our podcast specific Twitter account, Falcoholic Pod, for updates when this podcast comes out. And of course, go to thefalcoholic.com for daily articles about your favorite NFL team, the Atlanta Falcons. So for our special guests, Dr. Saad Omer and Dr. Zach Binney, and for Gina Thomas and Matt Chambers, this is David Walker. Thank you guys for listening in. We'll talk with you next time.